This recording was made at a public hearing held by the Federal Election Commission on Thursday, January 26th. Should you have questions after listening to this recording, please call the FEC at 800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Good morning. The special session of the Federal Election Commission for Thursday, January 26, 2006 will come to order. Welcome to the second day of hearings on the Commission's proposed rules regarding coordinated communications. Yesterday we had three lively and informative panels and look forward to hearing from our witnesses today. Each of today's panels will last for an hour and a half, and each witness will have 5 minutes to make an opening statement. We have a light system at the witness table to help you keep track of time. The green light will start to flash when you have 1 minute remaining. The yellow light will go on when you have 30 seconds left, and the red light means that it's time to wrap up your remarks. For each panel, we will have at least one round of questions from the commissioners, the general counsel, and our acting staff director. We may have time for two rounds of questions, and actually yesterday we were able to have two rounds of questions for each of the panels. We'll have a short break between the first two panels this morning, followed by a lunch break before the third panel this afternoon, about a two-hour break in the middle of the day to do that. Our first panel this morning consists of William McGinley on behalf of the National Republican Senatorial Committee, Cleta Mitchell from the law firm of Foley and Lardner here in Washington, and Brian Swoboda on behalf of the Democratic Legislative Campaign Committee. So if the panelists are ready, we welcome you to come to the witness table, and we typically proceed in alphabetical fashion in terms of opening statements. So that would mean that Mr. McGinley, we would hear first from you, then Ms. Mitchell, and then we would hear from Mr. Swoboda. So Mr. McGinley, whenever you're ready to begin, we look forward to your remarks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Vice Chairman, Commissioners. Thank you for the opportunity to present this testimony on this important rulemaking. Here we go again. The coordination rules impact, under consideration today, impact every facet of the NRSC's operations, including its relationship with its federal candidates, state and local candidates, and like-minded outside groups. They even impact which vendors the NRSC will retain for communication and political strategy services. Thus, the NRSC is providing these comments as a member of the regulated community that must operate under these rules. It's important to note that many organizations have begun making plans for the 2006 election year in reliance on the existing rules. In fact, as of the date of this hearing, five states holding U.S. Senate elections are currently within the 120-day time window. Those states are Texas, Indiana, Nebraska, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and West Virginia. During the month of February, while the Commission deliberates on these rulemakings, nine more states will enter the 120-day time period. So the context of the testimony that we're providing today is real, and we are currently struggling to understand where the Commission will be going with this and to plan accordingly for this election year. With that in mind, the NRSC asks if the Commission expands the types of communications that are subject to the coordination analysis under the rules, that you delay the effective date until after the election. We've already made plans in reliance upon the 120-day standard. If you decide to expand that, we would ask that it take effect for the 2008 election cycle. On the other hand, if the Commission narrows the types of communications that are subject to these analysis, that will not impact our plans, and we would ask that it take effect immediately. Any changes to the rules must provide the regulated community with clear notice concerning which communications will be subject to analysis. The Commission must remain mindful that these rules impact core First Amendment speech and activities, and it should reject any proposed changes that create subjective, expansive, content and conduct standards under the rules. In addition, these rules must not be developed through the enforcement process. Investigations concerning coordination allegations are burdensome and intrusive matters for the respondents and the witnesses. These investigations have a chilling effect on participation in the political process. Respondents and witnesses are forced to allocate resources to comply with the Commission's subpoenas rather than promoting their political agenda or candidates. This creates an opportunity for abuse in the enforcement process and is a severe process penalty for those subject to this, especially if they are later found, if no violation is found. In particular, the NRSC would like the Commission to address the common vendor standard under the conduct standards. The NRSC supports creating a rebuttable presumption against coordination for vendors who create internal firewalls. to ensure that no material information is user conveyed between their clients. Vendors that take steps to preserve their clients' confidential information by assigning specific personnel to specific clients, requiring employees to establish and maintain protocols to protect information, or other similar steps should benefit from this rebuttable presumption. Common vendors or overlapping common owners or overlapping administrative personnel, such as accounts receivable personnel or office managers or similar type of personnel, should not meet the evidentiary threshold to initiate an intrusive investigation into these matters. There must be a credible allegation or evidence concerning the use or conveyance of material information about specific communications for the Commission to find reason to believe and initiate an investigation. In addition, the NRSC supports reducing the time period for the common vendor standard from the current election cycle to a shorter time period. If a week is a lifetime in politics, then the current election cycle standard is too broad. Finally, the NRSC supports a rebuttable presumption against a finding of coordination in the case of the use of publicly available information. This safe harbor would go to the conduct standards under the coordination analysis. The use of publicly available information about a candidate or a political party committee should not satisfy these standards. The safe harbor would apply if the respondent can demonstrate that the information used in the communication was received or available from a source other than the candidate or the political party referenced in the election. There is no secrets in politics anymore. I like to refer to the 2004 election cycle and see that Dan Balls had basically strategy memos published in the Washington Post. If people are sponsoring communications that go relying upon the information in these articles or press releases or information on publicly available websites or summaries of newspaper articles about candidates or political parties, that is information in the public domain. It doesn't matter what type of form it takes. It should not satisfy the conduct standards and the coordination analysis. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Mr. McGinley. Ms. Mitchell, good morning.
Is it on? Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the Commission. I'd like to just take one moment of personal privilege and welcome the new members of the Commission to our playground and to tell you, to all of you, thank you for your service. This is a fairly thankless job, and I think, as Mr. Norton can tell you, and his staff, and all of this rulemaking that seems incessant, but thank you for taking the time in your lives to devote to this commission. I echo Mr. McGinley's comments about the need for a bright line. We have come to a point in time where we seem to have forgotten one of the very most important principles enunciated by the Supreme Court in Buckley, which was that people have a right to know in advance what speech will be subject to government regulation and what speech will not. And so I urge the Commission, in whatever decision you make, to please enunciate bright lines. Let people know in advance. Not 2 years later in an enforcement action where attorneys come along and ask for every single thought process, meeting, piece of paper that may have gone back and forth between a committee, an organization, a member of Congress, a vendor, and try to reconstruct after the fact, well after the fact, whether or not some prohibited activity may have taken place. So please, don't take the coward's way out. Enunciate clear, bright lines in the regulations, and do not rely on an enforcement action process for determining, like the Supreme Court once referred to as obscenity, that you'll know it when you see it. That is not an appropriate way to for the regulated community or the people of the United States to have to deal with a process of involving themselves in politics and public policy. The second point I would make is that I would urge the Commission to adopt the 30-60-day guidelines. Congress saw fit to articulate that 30 and 60 days before an election was the appropriate time frame in which it could be said that certain communications would be deemed to be public election related. And the reform community spent quite a lot of money and a number of years amassing a great body of evidence to support that proposition that 30 days before a primary and 60 days before an election, radio and television communications could be deemed to be election-related. And the Supreme Court agreed with that. It seems to me that Congress having decided and the Supreme Court having upheld on the recommendation of the reform community that election-related communications or it could be presumed that communications would be election-related if they occurred during that time frame, it seems perfectly appropriate for the Commission to adopt that view. The third point I would make is that within that 30 and 60-day window, I would urge the Commission to do as was suggested in one of the alternatives, to adopt some safe harbors, some specific safe harbors. In particular, a safe harbor for legitimate legislative communications. It is clear, and I've submitted in my testimony the evidence that is posted on the website of the U.S. House of Representatives, all of the adjournment and recess dates of the Congresses since the beginning of the Republic. It is clear that in the last, I would say since World War II, and particularly in the last 25 years, that Congress makes no pretense of adjourning and going home before the election season starts. The earliest adjournment date of Congress in the last 25 years was October the 4th. Every other adjournment date has been near or after the election, with periods of recess during the October time frame. That means that Congress is making important legislative decisions within what we would call the 60-day blackout period. And it is completely inappropriate not to recognize that and not to have some safe harbor provisions that would recognize that period and for people to be able to engage in communications that reference members of Congress as it relates to legislation. So I'm happy to answer questions, but it seems to me that these are important principles that balance the First Amendment interests of the people against whatever corruption issues may be at hand. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mitchell. Mr. Swoboda.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to thank the Commission for the chance to testify and for their willingness to hear a wide range of diverse and contentious views, and that's just from my own law firm. But that aside, I'd also like to thank the staff for helping put this together so quickly and so efficiently. Unlike my fellow panelists, I'm here, I guess, as a bit of a one-trick pony. I'm here on behalf of the Democratic Legislative Campaign Committee and to talk specifically about state and local candidates and one particular way in which they are affected by the current rules and apt to be affected by the rules that you're considering. And that is, in the practice, what until 2002 had been the long-standing practice of state and local candidates paying for advertisements and communications that noted their endorsement by federal candidates. Before BCRA was passed, this was a long-standing and, frankly, unlike so many other things in the law, well-understood practice among both federal candidates and state and local candidates. The bedrock, to the extent there was one, was Advisory Opinion 1982-56, where the Commission said that absent an indication that the communications were intended to influence the endorsing candidate's own election, their costs would not be treated as contributions to the federal candidate who appears in an ad or a direct mail piece for a state or local candidate and declares their support for that candidate. The Commission in that opinion talked about a number of specific considerations that might affect that decision. They talked about whether the endorsing federal candidate was identified only as an office holder, whether there was a reference to the endorsing federal candidate's campaign, whether there was express advocacy of the federal candidate's election or election, or whether there was a solicitation of funds on behalf of the federal candidate. And these rules were pretty well understood by the regulated community before 2002. And indeed, they were well understood, I would submit, by the Congress when it considered passage of BCRA in 2002. The record before Congress when it took up the Shazmian and McCain-Feingold bills was remarkably bereft of instances of federal candidates appearing in sham endorsement advertisements. Senator Feingold, for example, on March 20, 2002, went to the floor to assure his colleagues that the legislation would not affect the ability of state and local candidates to note the endorsement of federal candidates, absent absent promotion or support of the endorsing federal candidate. And finally, while Congress directed the Commission to consider certain subjects while drafting its coordination rules, this particular subject was not among them. So a state legislator, a member of Congress, leaving passage of the Shays-Meehan or McCain-Feingold bill might very well have concluded that the world was going to continue as it had before with respect to that practice. Comes now Jonathan Weinzapfel, who comes to the Commission in Advisory Opinion 2003-25 and seeks permission to have Senator Evan Bayh endorse him in an advertisement. And obviously the critical question on Mr. Weinzapfel's mind at that time was whether the endorsement would be construed as promotion or support of Senator Bayh that would violate the new statute of 441IF. And to the surprise perhaps of Mr. Weinzapfel and Senator Bayh, and to the surprise of state legislators like those associated with my client, the commission went not only answered that question, but also laid through the application of its coordination rules and the 120-day bright line standard. And the good news for Mr. Weinzapfel was that the ad was deemed permitted in that instance. The bad news was the commission sent a clear signal that had that ad appeared within 120 days of Senator Bayh's election, the ad would be treated as a contribution to Senator Bayh by operation of the commission's content standard there in place. Comes next President Bush and Alice Forgy Kerr, the candidate for Congress in Kentucky, and the commission goes through the same analysis. And the good news for Mrs. Kerr in that situation was that the commission provided a process by which President Bush could essentially buy into the ad and pay for what was deemed to be his fair or allocable share of it. But then in that same footnote, or in that same advisory opinion in footnote 3, the commission expressly withheld the notion that this might be applied to candidates for state and local office. The commission said it reiterated that the determination about attribution in this advisory opinion applies only to two federal authorized committees spending entirely federal funds. So at this point, at the beginning of 2004, the door, as a practical matter, had been effectively closed to the practice that once had prevailed before BICRA, and that I would submit Congress had understood would continue. And this is especially ironic given the legitimate interest that state candidates have in being able to feature federal candidates in their endorsements. As I mentioned in my comments, state candidates are often not as well known in the community as federal candidates. They tend to need the approbation of more compelling figures. And I see my time has expired, and I appreciate the Commission's forbearance.
Thank you, Mr. Swoboda. Our questioning will begin this morning with Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Brian, I'm glad you're here, because when Mark left yesterday, I had some unanswered questions about endorsements, of all things. I guess I completely accept what you're saying, and I understand that most of these endorsements are completely innocuous, and from the standpoint of the federal office holder, it's all the benefit flows to the endorsee rather than the endorser. Nevertheless, it's not that hard to come up with scenarios where the process could be abused. You know, envision a troubled Senate candidate who stands there and the ad shows the senator in full view saying, "I'm Senator Jane Doe. America needs strong leaders. Leaders who'll stand up for family values. Leaders who'll stand up for this. Leaders who'll stand up for that." And in the last moment of the commercial, it broadens out and there's somebody standing next to Jane Doe and she says, "That's why I'm endorsing State Senator so-and-so, because people like me need people like her to be in office." I mean, you can imagine scenarios where it could be abused. So I think that there's a lot of sympathy up here for creating some kind of an endorsement exception, but the question is, how do we do it to avoid the reformers coming in and yelling at us for opening up these huge loopholes? You know they're prone to do that. So we've been toying with different formulations.
If that's the standard, I think you might as well give up.
Well, no matter what
you do, they're going to yell at you. So just do the right thing and don't worry about that.
That is a very fair point. And we always appreciate your plain-spoken comments, Ms. Mitchell. we've been playing with different formulations, and it was suggested yesterday we could say we'd allow endorsements as an exception as long as it didn't contain express advocacy. But some of us feel that that might not hold up to judicial scrutiny, given what not only the Supreme Court but the Court of Appeals has said about express advocacy. And given what Ms. Mitchell was saying about bright lines, and I also am a fan of bright lines, if we were to use a PASO standard, which I have to say it surprised me, but several people in various contexts in this hearing have been suggesting that we import PASO standards into various places. If we said there's an exception for endorsements as long as they don't PASO the federal candidate who's making the endorsement, would you understand what you could say in the ad? Would that be workable for you, or do you have a better suggestion?
Well, first off, I guess I'd observe that both Congress and the Commission have already created that standard. A state legislator who wishes to sponsor an ad featuring a federal candidate is prohibited by 441IF and the Commission's implementing regulation from promoting or supporting the endorsing federal candidate. So that rule already exists. I would submit that in the case of legislative candidates, it serves as a significant bulwark against the concern that you raise, and it would be accordingly difficult, I think, for the reform community to contend that that was somehow contrary to law, since it was in fact the law that they in fact drafted, and that they in fact, through Senator Feingold on the floor, in considering McCain-Feingold, you know, laid out as the sine qua non of state candidates touting federal candidate endorsements. As to whether that standard is understood among the regulated community by state legislators, I would submit that at present it is. I think that there is a a hypothetical along the lines of what you laid out, I think, would obviously raise concerns for an endorsing candidate and for certainly the lawyer counseling that endorsing candidate. One observation that I might make, though, is that it should be noted that the PASO standard applies specifically in the statute and in the regulations to state party communications, local party communications, and communications by state and local candidates. To the commission, to the extent that the commission finds utility in that standard in other contexts, elsewhere in the statute and elsewhere in the regulations, that places a lot of weight, frankly, on the regulations that already apply to state and local candidates. So in other words, the more widely applied a PASO test is, and the more significant it is when you assess the activities of 527s, of nonprofit organizations, of other types of groups, then I would suspect over time the range of conduct in which a state legislator might be able to engage in might narrow accordingly. The fights, as these play out in enforcement and the interpretation process, are going to be over what is promotion and support and what is not, and I think you want to avoid a situation where you have a circumstance where endorsements are permitted, but only if the federal candidate appears in front of a blue screen with a scowl on his face for no more than 5 seconds. And I fear that the more broadly a PASO standard is applied, the more difficult it will be for that type of conduct to occur.
Well, that was very helpful, but you used up all my time. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner Weintraub. Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. McGinn, I'd like to ask you a question on an issue you raised in your written testimony, but I'd also like the response of the other two panelists on it. You suggest in your written testimony that there should be a de minimis exception even if communication meets the rest of the rule. You know, however we come out with the end rule, there should be a de minimis exception. And you put it down, it ought to be for 500 people. So if there is a coordinated communication, I assume, but if it goes to 500 people or less, then there should be no violation. Frankly, that seems like too small a de minimis exception. And I base that on my personal experience and census demographics. I started off in local politics a long time ago as a precinct chairman. I was then on election board that regulated and ran elections in precincts. The average precinct size, I think, across the United States is anywhere between 2,000 and 3,000 people. If we use your rule, you're saying that if somebody sends a mailing out to 1,000 people, which is half of one precinct, why then it's something that's so bad we should regulate it. The demographics of this are that the average size of a congressional district, according to the 2000 census, is about 650,000 people. Your 500-person standard would mean that if you go over 0.08% of the population of a congressional district, well, then you suddenly have a problem under our regulations. I wonder whether that is not too small and whether a more appropriate standard might be, for example, the standard that Congress itself applied in the area of electioneering communications, where the target electorate has to be at least 50,000. Well, 50,000 persons is about 8% of the average size of a congressional district, at which point you're probably just starting to actually affect voters with what you're doing. What's your reaction to that?
Actually, 2 points on that. I think the point I was trying to get across when I was discussing a 500-person threshold is the context where maybe a state candidate has a fundraiser, where they invite 400 people to the fundraiser. It lists the federal candidate on there. It's going to be reviewed by the federal candidate for appropriateness and for compliance with the applicable advisory opinions for participation in a state candidate fundraiser. So it wouldn't be subject to the coordination analysis. In other words, what it would do is it would permit federal office holders to participate in low distribution for invitations for a state candidate fundraiser. That was the context in which I was referring to the 500, and if it didn't come across clearly, I apologize. On the other hand, when we're talking about the distribution of communications that go beyond advertising campaigns that, for example, in Washington, D.C., sometimes what people do is they run advertisements in the D.C. media markets to get across to a grassroots lobbying perspective. If they're talking about a situation that might involve representatives from Virginia, Maryland, in some cases Pennsylvania or West Virginia, you may have some spillover into those jurisdictions if they reference those candidates. I think a percentage basis would be a more workable rule in that situation. In other words, where you have if you have a larger communications campaign that says call your senator, and it spills over into a neighboring jurisdiction for a Senate candidate who's up for election, but the distribution is, say, 5% as compared to the overall national advertising campaign, that should be incidental to the larger campaign. There's no intent to benefit that candidate, and it should be exempt from the coordination rules. For the 500-person or less rule, we're talking about the grassroots events at the state or local level where a state senator so-and-so wants Senator McGinley to show up as a featured guest. They send out 400 invitations. It's less than 500. The benefits running to the state candidate, it's not a large distribution, and the coordination rules should not kick in that instance. And so, in other words, taking the standard for direct mail for phone banks and making sure that it applies to state candidate fundraiser invitations and other types of communications, sponsored by somebody other than the candidate of the political party referenced in the communication.
Do you have a number in mind for the second situation you were talking about? You suggested a percentage. I mean, are you talking 5%?
I'm talking, 3 to 5%, something in that neighborhood where it's truly incidental. It's not a significant number. I mean, it may reach a significant number of people, but it is incidental to the overall advertising campaign. I mean, as I pointed out in the written comments, I mean, the commission has used that type of methodology before in the context of restricted class solicitations. If there's an incidental distribution beyond the restricted class, it's de minimis and no one's going to be held accountable for soliciting beyond the restricted class. The similar type of principles should apply here.
Okay. Thank you. I think I'm next up, so... Ms. Mitchell, in your comments, you cite, I think, an important evidentiary issue that the Commission faces, and that is what the record evidence is in terms of the proportion of election-influencing ads that run in the last 30 or 60 days before an election, and versus what proportion of those types of ads might run in earlier time periods. And I guess in page 5 and 6 of your comments, you cite to a number of expert reports that were prepared in the McConnell litigation, and one that stood out in the middle of page 5. I believe it was the expert report by Professor Goldstein of the University of Wisconsin. But you a quote from that report, and you indicate that Goldstein found that 78% of interest group ads that mentioned a federal candidate aired within 60 days of the general election, and Goldstein went on and found that 85% of ads mentioning a presidential candidate aired within 60 days of the general election. And I guess, and I'm going to be interested in pulling that study and looking at it, and I guess the upshot of that would be that for presidential campaigns, only 15% of the ads mentioning a presidential candidate aired earlier than the last 60 days before an election. I guess my question, two questions. First, in looking at the evidentiary record, do you think that this type of analysis is what the commission should be focusing on? And also, if we were to find that studies like Goldstein and others that may be out there, and we found that there were percentages in about these areas, you know, the high 70s to mid 80s in terms of the proportion of election influencing ads running in the last 60 days, do you think that's the kind of record that would allow the commission to have a time dimension like the 60-day window you're advocating?
Absolutely. I think that's exactly it. My reading of the decision of the Court of Appeals is that that is exactly what they're looking for from the commission. And to essentially what the commission would be doing is confirming the body of evidence that has already been assembled for at least one type of communication. And it seems to me to make sense to have a consistent standard for other types of communications. I mean, because we're really, that's what we're really talking about, is whether they're election related. And that body of evidence has already been assembled, submitted, and accepted by the Supreme Court. So it seems to me for the commission to confirm that that is appropriate for other purposes and other communications is totally appropriate for the commission to do, and is, it would seem to me exactly what this, the court is looking for. I still would argue that it is important that my objections notwithstanding, the court has disagreed. I've never understood why it is presumed. We now presume there is a legal presumption that any television or radio ad within 30 days of a primary or 60 days of a general is election related. The law presumes that. So I don't know why we wouldn't adopt that standard for phones, mail, other kinds, not the internet.
We look forward to getting to that in the weeks
that's
ahead.
Right. But I do think the commission, because we're now talking about an expanded definition, because we're talking about coordination with members of Congress and candidates, I mean, that's really what we're talking about. And I just do not believe that that the commission can walk away from the necessity of recognizing the interaction between members of Congress and their staffs and outside groups. I've always, that term, outside of what? I mean, people have a right under the First Amendment to be part of that, the process of legislation.
If I could follow up on that point, because I think one of the things we're going to be grappling with is, let's say we have an evidentiary record that is along the lines of what Professor Goldstein has assembled or other people may have assembled, and we can point to numbers in these ranges, the 85% range, the high 70s range. One argument that could be advanced is, well, if there's any election-influencing ads outside the window, then the window can't be constructed, that essentially we have to get to 100%. And my question would be, do you read the law as requiring that kind of approach? And also, to what extent, you know, as you read McConnell, even when McConnell rejected an overbreath challenge to the electionary communications rules, the opinion, I think, was pretty clear that there probably were some ads within those windows that did not have an election-influencing record still sufficient to have a bright-line rule. How do you come out on that?
Well, I think that it is clear that the reform community would like to have no time limits and no content standards, so that and members of Congress would love not to have people saying bad things about them ever. They want to be the only ones who get to communicate about themselves. I just don't think the First Amendment allows that. I hate to remind them of that, but believe me, we've all heard it. We know that what they're really over there worrying about on both sides of the aisle is that there are these pesky people out there who are saying things about them, about their voting records, about, you know, some position they've taken, and they would really like to ban that full-time, year-round, day in and day out. The commission's job, painful though it is to set a bright line standard that recognizes that this body of evidence shows that at certain times you can legally presume that communications are election related. And outside of that, you really have to balance the interests of the rest of the First Amendment to petition the government.
So would it be your view that whatever test we construct, we do not have to have an evidentiary record that shows that there is no chance for any election influencing ad to ever run outside that window, but instead we have to be able to show that the vast majority of the activity will be within the windows?
I think that's right. I think it's exactly right, and I think you can rely on the provision of Buckley that I quoted in my testimony, which is the distinction between discussion of issues and candidates and advocacy of election or defeat of candidates may often dissolve in practical application. Candidates, especially incumbents, are intimately tied to public issues involving legislative proposals. You can never totally separate it. They are, in fact, elected officials. We do want to know their positions on issues and legislation. We're not asking them who they're picking for the Super Bowl.
I mean, although we'd be interested, but
so I do. I think the record that you accumulate and put forward has to be directed toward balancing those First Amendment interests.
Thank you. My time has expired, Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to thank the panel for the time they devoted to preparing the comments for us. It is enormously helpful. I think I share the concern that you've expressed about the need to create a standard that is sufficiently clear that the people who are trying to comply with the law can understand it and can comport themselves in a way that will allow them to avoid unnecessary legal entanglements. The problem that I'm confronted with here derives from the Court of Appeals decision in which they struck down our rule on APA grounds. And they have instructed us to build a record that justifies whatever line we do draw. There were several specific questions that the court guided or directed us to resolve, and one of them involved the potential or risk that by creating a bright line somewhere that we would open the door or permit people to engage in coordinated activities outside of that line, and that this could present the risk of circumvention. The question, I guess, I had for you, given that you have an enormous amount of experience in the actual operation of the political world, is whether there is anything other than our regulations that would limit cause not to occur groups to engage in coordinated activities outside of whatever bright line we draw that would result in circumvention of the act. And the specific it's not a hypothetical, it's actually an ad that is running or has run that was presented to us by one of the commenters involved, an advertisement addressed Rick Santorum's qualifications as much as a human being as anything else. And it ran, I believe it was 178 days prior to the election, and described in the most abstract of terms him as a pro-tax cutting human being, and encouraged people to call and just congratulate him on his status as such. It didn't seem to be particularly tied to any lobbying, any particular bill that was pending in Congress, or any issue that was a particular public controversy, there was no evidence that this ad was coordinated, but I can easily imagine the Court of Appeals being concerned that if were we to draw a bright line, that this would permit, it would be legally lawful for the campaigns to coordinate, to ask or request or suggest that outside groups fund those kinds of ads. And so I go back to my question for you, which is there anything else that's going on in the world, other parts of the statute, practical realities of politics, other things that might lead us to conclude that this is not a significant concern as we try and determine where the standard should be?
Well, I think the first thing is availability of resources. I mean, every group I've ever been involved with has had a limited amount of money. They're not unlimited. They don't have unlimited funds, and they like to target their money for the issue of that's most important to them at the time when it's most important to them. And sometimes that falls within the period that would be the blackout period, and sometimes it doesn't. It just seems to me that going back to the studies quoted that I quoted in my testimony and that were presented as evidence in the McConnell case, that they have all these experts who said X percent, huge percent, is of ads that mention a candidate within this time frame are election related, and there is testimony as well that ads run outside of that time period tend not to be election related. I mean, they've testified to both ends of the timetable. So I think that what we have to recognize is the realities that organizations weigh in when they think it matters because they have limited resources, and so they do it when it matters. And it may be, you know, we're going to restrict them within the period just prior to an election, but I just cannot fathom that we would restrict them outside of that established time period.
One thing I might add, Commissioner, is that Congress made different choices with respect to different kinds of actors. And in the case of actors like my clients, they chose to treat them more harshly. They said to us that cycle-wide, regardless, 120 days, 180 days, I mean, cycle-wide, you may not promote or support a federal candidate in your public communications. And to the extent that the Commission would propose to compound that by saying you not only must comply with that requirement in the statute, and you may not distribute public communications in which they appear at all within 120 days, strikes me as perhaps contrary to the congressional design. That, in other words, the Commission is actually going beyond what Congress intended to permit when it constrained the practices of state and local candidates by adding an additional burden above and beyond what Congress seemed to want to require. So it's, I guess my response to your question is that it's actually a two-way street. There may be instances where the statute might permit conduct that Congress might have intended to restrict, but in the particular instance of the people I'm here representing, the Commission has actually compounded the regulation that Congress established at the outset.
Can I make just three quick points on that question? The first one is, I think the Court of Appeals may have misunderstood it. Bright lines don't create opportunities for circumventing the purposes of the Act. I think it creates a vehicle for complying with the Act. It gives the regulated community advance notice as to what they can do and what they can't do, what will be subject to regulation as opposed to what will be free. The other thing is that sometimes candidates and office holders themselves are a good vehicle for discussing issues. I mean, for example, how many people outside the Beltway know of the Bipartisan Campaign Reform Act? They probably don't know it by that. They may know it by McCain-Feingold. And if they happen to be on the ballot at that time, that could be passoing those candidates if you aired in their jurisdictions. So I think that when we're talking about the discussion of issues versus the discussion of candidates or office holders, we need to understand that when somebody is crafting an ad, there's a particular point that they want to get across, and that may not have anything to do with the election. But a federal candidate, himself or herself, may be the proper vehicle for educating the public about that type of issue. Finally, the third thing is, you asked for a practical limitation on what people are doing as far as communications. The 60-30 day seems to be when the public pays attention. In the primary time frame, they're not paying attention. You know, there's a post-Labor Day rule, you know, for the general election, which is typically the last 60 days before a general election, where people really begin to pay attention. And if you talk to some of the communications experts, they're going to say it's going to go beyond that because we got to deal with the World Series, you know, so or the baseball playoffs. So, you know, I mean, people really, there are practical considerations there where the public is not paying attention to it. That sometimes what it is grassroots lobbying that comes up against the election time frame. But as far as the election communications itself, communicating with voters to educate them about who they should choose at the ballot box or the positions of candidates, 60-30 seems to be the time frame in which people pay attention for election purposes.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I see my time has expired.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chairman. Commissioner Mason.
Thank you. Cleta and Bill, both of you talked about, I think, a safe harbor for publicly available information. And I understand what you're trying to get at, but I sort of have a suspicion that it won't buy you as much as you think. And let me explain why and get your reaction. You seem to be saying, well, if we can show that this was up on a website somewhere or in the newspaper, we're off the hook. But the problem that I see is that that doesn't mean that there wasn't a request from the candidate. All right? The campaign manager could have called the group and said, did you see that Dan Balls article in the Post? Are you going to do anything about it? It sure would help. I know it doesn't happen. It's very unlikely. The trouble that we have, though, is that once we get a credible allegation, and that's a tough one, what's the threshold of credibility, we're sort of off and running. I just want to get your reaction to that in terms of if you really think it's going to shut down an investigation, or if you intend it that way, how do we deal with the allegation that, the campaign and the outside group shared information, and the fact that some of that information, or maybe even most of it, may also have been available publicly, doesn't really answer whether or not there was this cooperation between the campaign and the outside group?
Well, I think that you're talking about two different, I think you're mixing two different standards. Of course, obviously, it's all up for grabs, but a specific request, a specific suggestion, is different from the available information. What we are talking about, I'm quite certain what we're talking about, are the situations where there is no overt request or suggestion, and trying to extrapolate. Well, because that's really the problem. There's no specific request or suggestion. The organization makes a communication based on publicly available information, and that should be protected. What you're suggesting?
I understand, but our problem is, and your problem is, you want to address this at the RTB stage. You're looking at a standard where you can say, here was the article, here was the website, and so on.
And there was no request.
And, well, but that's our problem, is that most of the time we get an allegation that says so-and-so, coordinated their advertising with such-and-such, and the evidence is a common vendor. And, or the evidence is something else. They both attended Grover Norquist's meeting, right? That's suspect in and of itself.
I understand that, but I think that
how does that help us, get at these frankly vague but not totally baseless allegations of coordination?
Well, let me just say, I think absent more. That's my position. Absent more, absent a request or suggestion, that is in and of itself that meets the conduct standard. I have no doubt that the commission will retain that, because that's been the case for 30 years. So I have no reason to think you're going to abandon that at this point. But absent that, then what we're moving into is more murkier areas. And so if it's publicly available, if it's a statement in a big room with a bunch of people and somebody goes out and does something, it just seems to me that as long as it's not the wink, wink, request, suggestion, and I just don't think you can extrapolate and say publicly available information somehow meets that standard, Bill.
I would simply, the way that I try to explain it is the difference between private needs, strategies, or projects of the candidate or the political party that's referenced in the advertisement versus publicly available information. The analogy I like to draw is to the copyright laws. The copyright laws protect the expression of information, but they don't protect the information itself. If a group or a party runs an advertisement that references a candidate, and they have a variety of information in that communication that you can point to the Washington Post, to the New York Times, to the local newspapers who have published it, that you can point to press releases that have been put out by a variety of different groups, including the candidate themselves, and that information goes into the communication, that shouldn't satisfy either the substantial discussion or the material involvement standards under the conduct portion of the regulations. In other words, what we're trying to do is the coordination rules are designed to prevent a candidate or a party committee from externalizing onto another party the needs that they have to fill in the gaps in their resources to get their communications out. That goes to strategy. That goes to plans. That goes to needs. It doesn't go to information about party committees or candidates that may be referred to. You know, if you're referring to the voting record of a candidate, that's publicly available information. People are putting out press releases all the time on a variety of candidates, and if that works its way into a communication, whether it came from the NRSC, from Americans United, or any of the other outside groups that, you know, that may be liberal-leaning in the election process, I mean, it seems to me that who cares? If it's out there in the public domain, it's not going to the private plans, needs, or strategies of the candidate or the party.
Mr. Chairman, my time's expired. I just want to make the point that I don't think any of us disagree. And when you ask for a safe harbor in terms of how we have been enforcing the act and will enforce the act, and when you ask for a safe harbor, you're asking for some insurance. My problem is, as much as I agree with you, I just am not sure that putting in even an explicit safe harbor in that regard in looking at our current coordination investigations is going to shut many of them down, because that, you know, typically isn't the, you know, the nub of the investigation. The nub of the investigation is, as Ms. Mitchell indicated, who did you talk to and when? That's the intrusive part. And even if you show us that all of this information was available in the public domain, if there's some evidence that there were conversations between the campaign and the outside group, we've got to inquire into that. So I'm just not sure how helpful that sort of an exemption would be.
It would be helpful.
Thank you, Commissioner Mason. Mr. General Counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and welcome to the panel. I was interested in the publicly available information exception, too, and so I want to try to follow up on Commissioner Mason's question, make sure I understand what you're suggesting. Let's say we have a situation where the facts are, or at least it's alleged, that a candidate approached a public interest group that was interested in an issue that the candidate was having tremendous success kind of hammering his opponent on. And the allegation is, or the evidence is, that the candidate said, look, I'm doing very well on this issue, hammering away my opponent, but looks like I'm going to run out of money to run radio and TV ads in about a month. And that's the allegation that we receive. And what we receive back from the respondent is an affidavit that says, doesn't address whether there were any communications with the candidate, but says, well, if you go to the FEC's website, you can discover that anyone could have discovered that this candidate was running short of money and couldn't have continued running radio and TV ads, and therefore the fact that I began running ads at this particular time was based on information that was publicly available. Should that be the end of it at the RTB stage?
Well, I think it goes back to my earlier statement. Absent more, yes, but it's the conversation and the communication. First of all, let me just say, it goes to the 30-60-day issue as well. Any campaign I've ever been involved in does their media buys from Election Day backwards for that very reason, because you want to make sure that you're on the air and out there closer to the election. So I hope nobody, I mean, that person is going to lose, so it was probably no big deal. But but the fact of the matter is, you know, I want to say something else about practicalities. I don't know many campaigns that really want other speakers out there making communications. What we really have here, to a great extent, is fear by campaigns and candidates that somebody else is going to communicate a message that they don't think is helpful to their own message. So, I mean, I just do not believe as a practical matter that there is a lot of effort put into by campaigns and candidates going to third-party groups and saying, gee, we want you up on the air doing this. But let's set that practical side, let's set that aside. I do think that your inquiry should be to the direct request or suggestion. I think that's the initial threshold inquiry. when you get, and then if they are willing to testify under oath that that did not occur, you know, then I think that these other things are secondary. And if it is publicly available information, they say, no, we never talked to anybody at that campaign, but we're not stupid. We hired our own pollster. Our communications were based on our own market research. We know what issues are working and what issues are not. We hate this guy. We want to beat him. And so we know what works and what doesn't. And, you know, we have our own information or it's publicly available. And if they can trace that they derive that their communications are based on publicly available information or their own private information, I do think the inquiry should stop.
Let me just try to clarify what you're saying. So if what we received as in response was an affidavit that simply said, I started running ads in these last couple of months based on the fact they were running out of money, but anyone could have discovered they were running out of money, and they simply don't address whether a conversation or series of conversations occurred, whether there was a request, I guess if I'm understanding you correctly, we would need more. We would need that person to come forward and say, not only was it publicly available, but there was no request or suggestion. And if we had all of that, then we could say no RTB.
Right. I think that
agree
you should
with
ask
that,
that
Mr.
question.
I think the point that I would make is that, you know, the regulated community has operated under these rules now for the 2004 cycle. And I think I can safely say that most federal candidates and political party officials know not to call up an outside group and ask them to come in and run an ad. And the reason that I say that is because people are paranoid about getting into an investigation. I mean, people have looked at what it takes to go through a coordination investigation based upon what happened pre-BCRA, realizing what could happen now, and I think they take extraordinary steps to try and avoid that. And I think that includes avoiding the request or suggestion or the substantial discussion conduct standards when it comes to advertisements that may be airing within the time periods that we talked about for the content standards. It seems to me that what we're talking about for the use of publicly available information is inadvertently tripping up the material involvement standard or some type of similar standard. That somehow you go through an investigation, you find an outside group that's been running an ad, you know, that references a federal candidate, and in their documents you find a press release from the candidate referenced in the ad. Well, the information contained in that press release somehow makes its way into one of the advertisements. That's a press release, something that's been discussed in the press that they've put out to the general public. It doesn't go to private plans, needs, or strategies. I mean, it's something in the public domain. It seems to me there should be some type of safe harbor or precedent that says that type of information is not going to, or that type of activity is not going to satisfy that conduct standard. I think that the safe harbor exception goes to the fact pattern where you don't want somebody to inadvertently get caught up in the conduct standards.
Seeing my time is up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Norton. Mr. Costa.
Yes. Thank you for coming. I had a question for Mr. McGinley. On the issue of firewalls and the use of common vendors, should the commission require specific contract language when a party or other political committee employs a vendor who is also working on behalf of a candidate? And would such language sufficiently insulate a political committee when a vendor fails to maintain that firewall?
I would actually agree with that. I mean, I think that candidates and political committees, when they contract with a vendor and they try and build firewalls into the contract so that the vendor is bound not to use or convey information that they glean from that campaign in connection with other clients, I think if the vendor doesn't satisfy that, I think that should go toward exonerating the campaign committee. I mean, it was pointed out in the original E&J that, you know, just the existence of a common vendor can't be per se coordination, that there has to be something more just than the existence of that type of relationship. And it also pointed out that vendors who follow standard business practices such as maintaining client, client confidences, not sacrificing one candidate's information by using it in another candidate, another group's advertisements or activities, that, if you follow those types of standard business practices, you're not going to have a problem under the common vendor standard. And so I think, to your point, I think evidence of contract language building those types of walls into the contract itself should create a presumption of compliance with the conduct standard.
And we have such a provision in the contracts, in the vendor contracts from the Republican Senatorial Committee. I mean, we try to make it clear to vendors that we expect any information derived from work performed for the National Republican Senatorial Committee is not conveyed to any other client. And we make them list other outside groups or clients that may, in fact, that they may do work for, so that we can know. We're trying. And I will say, I think the consultants are pretty well, I think they've, Bill's right. I mean, I think they've really, they're very careful about that. I think they try to be. They really try to be careful about that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Costa. Well, then we have time for a second round of questioning, and we can begin with Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do you think that given the number of vendors that are out there and the number of vendors who work for each side, because that's the way it works, that if we don't incorporate some kind of a provision like this that allows for firewalls, that it's going to impair your ability to find the people that you need to do the kind of work that you need to get done?
It's particularly a problem. Bill and I have talked about this several times. It's particularly a problem for small firms. Small firms are particularly disadvantaged because it's hard to firewall yourself. And so the big firms can do the firewalls a lot easier. So I do think that, but it is difficult. I mean, as we know, as you say, the consultants work for, they can't play for USC and Texas. And and then you get down to preferences and who do you like better, and who, people have groups that vendors that they rely on and have trust in, and so I think to the extent that there can be some specific guidelines and some protections, I think that's really important.
I think the short answer to your question is yes. I think there are some practical considerations there. I mean, there are just a limited number of people who provide the services that political parties and candidates need. I mean, and Kalita's right. I mean, it disproportionately affects smaller firms, and they like to call the coordination rules the Restraint of Trade Act. So, because it does limit the business opportunities that they may have.
But would it be a bigger problem if you want to avoid the inside the Beltway crowd and actually hire local vendors out in your home state? I would assume there'd be an even more limited supply.
That is absolutely true. And I come from a small state of Oklahoma, and trust me on this.
We've heard a lot about Oklahoma on this commission.
Well, I have to do the Oklahoma mention at least once during the hearing. But that is a huge problem for candidates and the parties in a small state.
Now, understanding that you would prefer for us to move to a 30-60-day time frame, or I guess a 60-day time frame, do you think that the current rule provides you with the kind of clarity that you need to advise your clients how to comply with the law?
Mm-hmm. I think the principles incorporated into the rule do, yes. The fact that there is a time period with which you need to be careful about who is referenced or what is referenced in the communications is helpful. And that, in addition to express advocacy, republication of campaign materials, or the electionary communication, I think that is helpful. And it allows the regulated community to know what they can and cannot do.
You know, some of the other commenters have raised the prospect that outside of the 120 days right now, there's this sort of free fire zone where a candidate could even go up to an outside group and say, hey, we're outside the 120-day window. Here's my ad. Please run it and pay for it. Are you that actually was suggested yesterday. Are you aware of anything like that ever happening?
No.
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 We need a verbal answer so we can get it.
No, absolutely not.
Thanks.
And I think it's for the two reasons that we've discussed before. Number one, no candidate or political party wants to lose control of message and say, would you please go run this advertisement? And then they're going to go out and say something that you didn't want them to say. So I think there's that messaging component to it, plus the allocation of resources outside 120. Nobody's paying attention.
And I might make one point about message control. I mean, it's kind of relevant, I think, to the situation of state and local candidates insofar as when federal candidates tend to participate in these communications, they tend to do it with the eye toward self-preservation rather than self-promotion. I mean, the question is more kind of vetting this text and making sure that it does them no harm, you know, such as, could you please excise the reference to returning the Panama Canal, you know, rather than, you know, gee, the picture of me is nice, but could you enhance the colors of the flag to make them more vivid and such? I mean, it's just the reality is that, you know, they're trying to avoid harm, active harm being done to them, and that tends to be the reason for their participation in this process rather than, you know, let me see if I can squeeze every ounce of mileage that I can get out of this.
Do you, do any of you see any reason why we should have different standards or different time frames for congressional versus senatorial versus presidential candidates?
No.
Not for the candidates themselves, but if you were to adopt a standard that involved outside groups with the candidate or party committee versus the party committee candidate, I think that you should have a shorter time frame in that period because it simply involves all hard money. I mean, from our perspective, we have no soft money, and it doesn't give an opportunity for you to get prohibited funds into the election process.
So you don't think that the presidential election cycle is inherently a longer period of time? You don't see it as a problem. Some of the commenters obviously do see it as a problem. There's this gap between the 120 days through the primary and then 120 days through the general, and they think there's this gap problem where things are unregulated.
Heaven forbid that there would be a time that was not subject to regulation, right? We can stay up all night and think up all kinds of horrible possibilities, but the reality is... let's try to keep it as simple as we can and applicable to federal candidates. I mean, there's nothing else in the statute that distinguishes between and among the treatment of candidates and committees other than the separate part about presidential matching funds. I mean, everything else, a federal committee, a principal authorized committee is a principal authorized committee. I think that it would not be a good idea to start making those distinctions. And the truth of the matter is, I mean, on what basis would you make a distinction? Frankly, there are, that percentage-wise, there are more competitive Senate races every cycle these days than there are House races, and I contend it's because the senators don't get to redraw the state boundaries every 10 years. So, I don't know on what basis you would actually make that distinction.
My time's up. Could I ask one more question? Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Witnesses have commented in general terms, and I saw some of this in your written comments, about the intrusiveness of investigations and the regulatory burden on your clients that results from that is worsened. The broader our rules are, the more of a burden, and the greater your concerns about intrusive investigations. And I wonder if you could I'm going to give you a few minutes to talk about that a little bit more about how that impacts your client's ability to conduct get their message out, to conduct their First Amendment activities.
Well, I'll just give an example. Actually, I mentioned this to Bill yesterday. I have a small little group in Illinois that formed a 527 and had a website and did some ads. And, you know, they're not very big, and they did a little bit, and their plan is to come back and do some more this year as it gets close to the election in Illinois, and it's all state candidate-related this year. They're going to eat up whatever money they had to for that because, you know, get an enforcement action a year and a half later. And, you know, so that's what we'll do this year. That's what they'll do this year. And, why? I mean, and the trying to make rules by enforcement actions is a very difficult and, I think, a burdensome process. We need to have procedures that I would urge the commission to adopt some procedures whereby people can... You can't end one of these things. You know, it's alive, and you can't stop them. You can't, I mean, and you know how it's ultimately going to end, but you still have to slog through the process. And there's no incentive to sua sponte report misdeeds. You know, I have a, you know, if you report something, shame on you for reporting it, because we're going to beat the living daylights out of you, and you've got this with you till you die. So,
I know what you're thinking.
You know, do something about, you know, find some ways to relieve some of the burdens from yourselves and from your staff.
Well, I'll give you an example of how that might have worked in a real-world context last cycle. Let's say you'd had a state candidate who wanted a federal candidate to endorse them, and they read the Forgy Kerr opinion and thought, well, we'll try to do it the right way. We'll have the federal candidate buy into the ad. Follow me, if you will, the fiction that the federal candidate would actually do this, but nonetheless. Let's assume that they had done that, and the federal candidate's opponent, you know, sees the ad, or the state candidate's opponent sees the ad, and they say, well, this is weird, you know, we don't know what this disclaimer means, this must be some sort of violation, so they file a complaint. And the complaint goes to the Office of General Counsel, and there's the initial query about what to do with the complaint. I file my response to the complaint saying, you know, we followed the procedure set forth in this advisory opinion. It was a reasonable thing to do. The text of the ad indicated no promotion or support of the federal candidate. But at some point, you know, it's possible that the answer might come back from somewhere in the agency. Well, the advisory opinion doesn't cover this situation because the commission in footnote 3 expressly said that it didn't. And so we're in a fight over whether the AO covered it or not, or whether the commission should proceed in the absence of the AO. Now, you war game all of this out to the fifth step, and if you're the federal candidate and the state candidate in the first instance, your answer to that is don't do it. I don't need the trouble. It's going to look weird. It's going to get attention. And unless this is really, really important to me, and unless I'm really, really willing to take the risk, which, by the way, federal candidates in this context seldom are, I'm not going to do it. And so the reaction is people don't do it, and you have a range of conduct that ought to be permitted under the law in which people don't engage because of that dynamic. And it's not necessarily it's not necessarily to suggest that the agency, you know, is somehow mishandling that dynamic or that it's somehow the agency's fault. It's just the reality of how the situation plays out, and it's the reality of how a risk-averse client on the front end is going to deal with that situation.
It seems to me that the issue is that the process can be the penalty for some of these folks, in that, you know, if they're ultimately not, there's not going to be a finding of probable cause there. They've gone through the pain and expense of the discovery process, complying with subpoenas, depositions, not to mention the fact that when it is finally comes out to the public file, there may be descriptions of the internal process by which they came about through these communications, so you have proprietary information that sees the light of day, and that would be the case for both the candidates in the party committees and the vendors themselves. And so, at the, you know, when the process goes through, you know, you'll hear from the regulated community, it seems that there's burden shifting. That once you get to the RTB stage and that an investigation is initiated, suddenly the burden's on the respondent to prove their innocence. Because in the coordination context with the conduct standards, if you've gotten past the threshold of the content standards and you work your way into the conduct standards, it seems that now all of a sudden you have to prove your innocence, or there's the potential for that type of situation, because what happens if there's an opportunity for coordination to occur? Well, you know, how do you prove a negative? And so I think, you know, what the regulated community is asking for, give us the clear lines so that we can take the steps necessary to comply with the law. It's not an effort to circumvent the law. It's an effort to comply the law, to make sure that, you know, we're not getting soft money into the federal election system. You know, but it still allow the opportunity for federal candidates to go down and support down-ticket, you know, candidates at the state and local level. You know, allow political party committees to interact with their candidates. We're the National Republican Senatorial Committee. Our members are the Republican members of the United States Senate. Yet the coordination rules require us to erect walls between ourselves and the campaigns for any communications that air within the applicable time period or that have the content that triggers the coordination rules. And so, you know, we're already trying to go through the hoops and hurdles to comply with this law. And if you create vague standards and we find ourselves in some type of investigation context, it makes it that much more difficult to prove that our efforts to comply with the law. So we're just asking for some clear markers to get through the process.
And presumably, if those clear markers, the further out those clear markers are, if we're talking about time limits from the election, the more all those factors come to play.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner Weintraub. Other than that, our rules are perfect and appropriate. Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
I'm going to go back to my initial question because, Ms. Mitchell, Mr. Soto, you all didn't get a chance to answer that. And I'd like you to tell me what you think a de minimis rule ought to be in the two situations that Mr. McGinley proposed. And I would say that he seemed to stick to the 500 in the local situation, which to me still seems extremely small, because if we go from the average congressional district size down to the average state house district size, my house district in back in Georgia was, I think, 50,000 people. Well, 500 voters, as I said, would have been one-fourth of one precinct, or less than 1% of a 50,000-person House district, which again just seems like such a minimal amount of people. It seems like you'd have to get much bigger before you're actually affecting the election. But what do you two think about that?
Well, I would suggest that perhaps because Congress has specifically articulated a standard for purposes of electioneering communications, that having that the 50,000 voters in a targeted area, in a media market that reaches 50,000 voters in a given district or state, it seems to me that you could rely on the congressional language in that regard. I mean, that Congress has already said that. So I think to select another number may get you back in problems with the Court of Appeals, because it will not be based on, unless it is based on some particular study or something. Congress has spoken on the targeted communication of 50,000 to those to voters who can vote for that candidate. And I think that, I think the commission would be wise to adhere to that particular description for a definition.
You mean the court? You don't think the court would recognize my personal experience as sufficient reason?
Well, I would, but I'm not sure the court would, actually. But I think that you could reasonably rely on congressional judgment.
Commissioner, there's actually an animating principle, it seems to me, beneath your question that I don't want to go unremarked, which is that the purpose of these rules is not to capture every communication from which a federal candidate might derive some benefit. I recall, for example, Commissioner Weintraub's first question to me, where she lays out situation of ads that, you know, in no way would benefit a federal candidate. That's actually not the standard. For example, in Advisory Opinion 1982-56, they acknowledge that endorsement ads did have a benefit for the federal candidate. The standard is whether the ad is for the purpose of influencing a federal election. And that's where these other exogenous factors, such as the audience principle that Cleta talked about, or whether it's other facts, affect the determination. So I think it's an important point to emphasize that the commission's task here is not to be, you know, like the little Dutch boy putting thumbs in the dike, trying to make sure that nothing leaks through that's going to inure any benefit to a federal candidate at all. The purpose here is to capture and regulate ads that are for the purpose of influencing a federal election. That's what Congress sought to do.
No other questions.
Thank you, Commissioner. I'm next up. I want to follow up on this directed to discussion. This question about should there be a numerical threshold for the directed to element. Our current regulations do not identify a numerical threshold, and we've discussed various types of thresholds. If we decide we were going to have a numerical threshold, would it be appropriate for us to not only look at whether or not a certain number of people in a congressional district could see the communication, but also that the communication aired when the candidate at issue was up for election? And so, for example, let's say you have a Senate candidate running in Illinois, and it seems like everybody in the world is a candidate as soon as they begin raising money, but the election may not be until, say, 2008. And maybe it's uncontested that more than 50,000 people could see a communication in the state of Illinois, but the person depicted is not running in 2006 and is not running until 2008. If we had a numerical threshold for the directed to element, do you think it would be appropriate for us to tie it to the requirement that the candidate actually be appearing on the ballot in that cycle? Ms. Mitchell?
Absolutely. And I think that that is something that the commission very badly needs to do. And I'll give you a perfect example is goes to the issue of the Wisconsin Right to Life ads that referenced both Senator Cole and Senator Feingold in the period of time just prior to an election, but Senator Cole wasn't on the ballot.
Even though he was a candidate.
He was a candidate.
But he was not on the ballot that cycle.
As defined by federal law. And the situation just this past fall where you have, and I think this is, let's assume that this had all happened in an election year. When, because I think this is exactly the kind of issue that we need to address. And that is, the judiciary committee completes its hearings on San Alito, and every day there are interest groups on both sides who are working with members and staff on this, on the issue of the judicial confirmation. They are very involved. These grassroots groups are very involved on both sides, as we all know. And suddenly, Senator Mark Pryor is identified as an undecided. So what happens? I mean, that communication is from senators and their staff to groups on both sides of the nomination or confirmation issue, and they go out and both sides start running ads and making phone calls and doing work in Arkansas to try to convince Mark Pryor to vote their way. Now, it seems to me that let's set that in time. Let's say that happens in October. It makes a difference whether he's on the ballot or not on the ballot if you don't have the legislative exception or safe harbor. But it seems to me that you cannot say it is election-related if he's not even on the ballot.
And, Mr. Swobod, I want to follow up on your point, because as I understand your testimony, the relevant analysis is not whether some communication at some level, some abstract level, could be said to benefit a candidate, but rather whether it's for the purpose of influencing that candidate's election. Would you be comfortable if we had a numerical threshold for directed to, that it, again, would be tied to whether or not that person's actually on the ballot that cycle?
I think that'd certainly be helpful in the case.
Would it be appropriate, as you understand the case law, for us to fashion an exemption along those lines? Would it be permissible?
I think it'd be permissible and appropriate. I think the commission's task here is to try, based on the guidance that Congress has provided, to develop empirical criteria for determining whether particular types of communications are for the purpose of influencing or not. And questions of the audience, of the size of the audience, are going to be relevant to that. The content of the communication is going to be relevant.
And whether the person at issue within that relevant audience is actually on the ballot that cycle.
Yes, I think to try to enforce a rule in an anomalous circumstance like that actually creates kind of the opposite risk for the commission, that its rules, you know, may at the end of the day not seem narrowly tailored and may actually prohibit conduct that ought to be lawful under the statute and under Congress's intent.
Well, to follow up on your point about anomalous rules, one that has been mentioned to us is the fact that under current commission regulations, there's no directed to or targeting element under the coordination rules for express advocacy communications, nor for republication of campaign materials. We do have the directed to element for the 120-day rule. And Mr. McGinley, my question would be, do you think it would be legally permissible for us to incorporate a directed to element across the board in the coordination setting, express advocacy, republication, and whatever standard we fashion in the 120-day rule?
I do.
And what would be the basis for that?
I think that at the end of the day, you'd have to direct it toward the voters who have an opportunity to vote for that candidate. And I think that there are a number of cases out there, and I'm trying to think of, you know, I think Buckley talks in terms of express advocacy, you know, of a clearly identified federal candidate. But the issue is that if the voters don't have an opportunity to act upon that electoral advocacy, it seems to be meaningless to that candidate. I mean, I think of the situation where we may want, you know, the NRSC may want to put out a solicitation in California that talks about we really need a lot of money to defeat a Democratic candidate in some other state. Right. It's not going to the voters in that state. It's going to a completely different jurisdiction. There's no electoral benefit, and it's a fundraising piece for us. I mean, it seems to me that that is something that should be permitted under the rules, and that the courts, where you don't have an opportunity for the recipients to take electoral action based upon what you're asking them to do in the communication, I think that would be permissible.
Do the other panelists agree that we ought to incorporate a directed to element for in the express advocacy area and across the board in coordination?
Absolutely. I included that in my comments, and I absolutely believe that should be done. That's something that would, again, and it's something on which people can rely. It cannot be, as Brian said, it cannot be said to influence the outcome of an election if the people cannot vote in that particular election. And we are
talking to be an impediment
about, all talking about public communications. Right?
And Mr. Swobod, you would agree in the express advocacy area?
Yes.
Thank you. Mr. Vice Chairman.
I have no further questions. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Then moving to Commissioner Mason.
Thank you. Ms. Mitchell, you've got some experience in campaigns, not only advising candidates, but running yourself. And I just wanted to ask on this common vendor time frame, is in the real world of campaigning, does having the inside skinny on what a campaign is doing in August have any relevance to what's going on in October?
Not necessarily. Things can, as some, I think Bill said, or someone said, that it's a lifetime. A week is a lifetime in a campaign.
And so a 60-day time frame that's reflected, for instance, in our polling, you know, regulations, the point at which a poll is considered virtually without value, would be similarly appropriate for the point at which inside information
I think that is a very good point, and the Commission, having already articulated rules on the valuation of polling data and when that ceases to have value and a sliding scale of value, that could well be applied to other kinds of information as well.
A couple of you have talked about this issue of the candidates not wanting to lose control of the debate. And that makes a lot of sense to me, and there are very pointed statements in the legislative debates over McCain-Feingold about why we got to shut down these electioneering communications and so on. And so it does seem sort of odd that there's this presumption they are running that way. Won't these people just shut up? And you're suggesting that that also goes to the outside groups, i.e., that even if it were legal, a candidate would be worried about trying to bring in an outside group because they're just not entirely sure that they're going to be all that reliable, or if some question comes up about the ad, that they won't say the wrong thing. They won't go off script and say, yeah, the Panama Canal really is, you know, whatever. But what sort of legal principle would we use to incorporate that presumption or that view into our regulatory framework?
I think the First Amendment might be a pretty good legal principle to rely on in that instance, and the right to petition the government, which I think is seemingly lost in the discussions often. We talk a lot about free speech, but we tend
to... Well, that goes to the speaker, which is outside group, but how do we go to the motive or involvement of the candidate? In other words, you seem to want us to build in a presumption that the candidate really doesn't want to coordinate, is suspicious of coordinating, and as I say, I think there's some evidence for that in their own words, but how do we build that in as a legal presumption?
What, that their fear of having outside groups involved? I think, you know, I think the legal principle is that it is inappropriate to protect members of Congress and candidates from the speech of others. That's inappropriate under the First Amendment. And there is ample evidence in the record, in the debates on BCRA, that was one of their motivations in adopting the law, was to try to silence groups with whom they disagreed and who disagreed with them. Maybe I'm misunderstanding your question, but...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Commissioner Mason. Next up, our general counsel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As you know, in McConnell, one of the many provisions challenged was the coordination provision in the statute. And what the Supreme Court said with respect to that challenge and in rejecting that challenge was this: and although plaintiffs speculate that the FEC could engage in intrusive and politically motivated investigations into alleged coordination, they do not even attempt to explain why an agreement requirement would solve that problem. That was the issue there. Moreover, the only evidence plaintiffs have adduced regarding the enforcement of the coordination provision during its 27-year history concerns three investigations in the late 1990s into groups on different sides of the political aisle. Such meager evidence does not support the claim that the provision will foster arbitrary and discriminatory application. The reason I come back to that is the point that, in particular, Ms. Mitchell and Mr. McGinley have made, that without various safe harbors, what we would have is intrusive investigations and burden shifting to respondents to prove their innocence. And I'm trying to think at a way to get at the concern that the court had and that the court we may be dealing with in the future may have about the empirical evidence that we need safe harbors to prevent intrusive investigations. And one one question I wanted to ask, starting, I guess, with you, Ms. Mitchell, as one of the preeminent practitioners and someone who represents quite a wide range of clients in the area, whether you know or could estimate how many enforcement matters you've handled where the commission found reason to believe that there was a violation of the 2002 coordination regulation.
Well, what's interesting to me is that in defending some actions, both for respondents and witnesses with respect to the 2004 cycle, I think people took great pains to try to ensure that they didn't cross the line on coordination and worked so hard at that that now the commission has seemed to take a different tack and now are defending whether or not certain actions converted their entity into a political committee. And so I think one of the surprises has been, in my experience, that there have not been as many coordination issues as we anticipated, and I think it is because people work very hard to try not to be guilty of violating the regulations. So my experience, my observation is that there have been surprisingly few violations. Now I know that I have another client where it was alleged, and the information was from a publicly available source, and was publicly available. There was an allegation of coordination, but the commission dismissed it, and then had to defend in federal court the decision to dismiss. So I would say that my observation is that people work pretty hard to comply with those regulations.
Can I just make a point? I mean, I think that two of the cases that the court was referring to and that you may be referring to in posing the question, they've been nicknamed the monster MERS.
Right.
Because even though, you know, you may not have a whole series of small skirmishes at the complaint phase or at the RTB phase, those two matters, if you take a look at the combined legal fees on both sides of the aisle and all those MERS, were not insignificant events. And I would also say that probably some of the vendors and the parties involved in those MERS are still active in politics today and learned a very hard lesson about how painful the discovery process can be. And chances are they're probably some of the most risk-averse people out there in the political process today. So I think I would simply recharacterize, I think, the point that you may be trying to make, which is what we don't need to do is we don't need to go out and count how many MERS have actually occurred underneath the coordination theory, whether pre-BICRA or post-BICRA. But instead, I think we need to take a look at, in those instances where MERS did develop into the discovery phase, what was the conduct of it? And if you take a look at how those have progressed, even if you didn't find probable cause, the respondents and the witnesses in those matters paid a very heavy price in terms of legal fees, in terms of when the matters finally were disclosed to the public, even though there was no probable cause finding. My guess is that there was quite a bit of proprietary information, both from the candidate, the party committee, the outside groups, and the vendors that made itself into the light of day that they probably wouldn't want to have out there.
I mean, I don't want to debate that point with you, but the court, I know in McConnell, had all of that evidence before it. Mm-hmm. And what they concluded was that three horror stories in a 27-year history was meager evidence.
Well, one comment I might add to that, Mr. Norton, is that, and I don't know that it was before the court in McConnell, is, and I don't know, frankly, that we've had the chance to test it really under the new coordination rules, is the power of a commission finding is inversely proportional to the size of the respondent on the other end. I mean, so for example, my son has a goldfish and was shocked to learn that when you knock on the tank, it seems like an earthquake to the fish. I mean, Bill McGinley's clients may eat, you know, reason to believe findings for lunch and respond to them routinely, but a reason to believe finding that sent woe betide the state legislative candidate who receives a reason to believe finding. And one of the things I think you've seen over the last 2 years, and part of the reason why it hasn't been that big of an issue in the enforcement process, is that legislative candidates, by and large, haven't generated those findings because they've sat out of the process, because they've said this isn't worth it. You know, we don't want to have to deal with the hassles of having federal candidates endorse us. So I don't know the extent to which the court's consideration of McConnell can seem both predictive and necessarily wholly grasping of the potential concerns that lie out there through applications of the enforcement process.
Thank you. I see my time is up. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. General Counsel. Mr. Costa.
I have no further questions, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. With that, then, that concludes this panel's testimony. Thank you very much for appearing. Your testimony was helpful, very helpful to the Commission. With that, then, we will take a 10-minute break, and we will take up the second panel at 11:15. Thank you.